Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the last meeting of the House Fraud, Waste, and State Agency Oversight Committee committee for this session. But we are going to continue to meet during the interim. So it's not our last meeting for 2025, but it is for this season of the session. So appreciate everyone's hard work and really look forward to this meeting diving into Medicaid fraud. But before we do that, I just wanted to spend just a second thanking our amazing staff who have worked so hard this session to make the Fraud and State Agency Oversight Committee a reality. So on the DFL side, we want to thank John Bowler and Anna Borgerling. Borgerding. Forgive me, Anna. Anna Borgerding, thank you. And on our side, we have Aaron, Caitlin, Lori Cousineau, and Harry Kennedy, who served with us for part of the session, and now his duties on the Ways and Means Committee have overtaken. So we appreciate Lori stepping up. And then, of course, nonpartisan Ben Johnson, you have been amazing. We're so grateful. None of this would have happened without the tremendous staff that have served our committee, and we're very, very much appreciative. With that, we do have a quorum, and I would like to ask Representative Rarick to move approval of the minutes from April 28th.
Madam Chair, so moved.
And Chair?
Yes, Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I don't know if the second presenter from the AG's office, if the last name is spelled correctly, maybe we can just, even if we approve this, maybe we can just get that. I see it says Washington, and not sure if there's supposed to be a G in there or not. Perhaps people have verified that there is not one. But
Mr. Attorney General, is it correct?
Washington.
Yes.
B. Yeah. With a G. Okay.
Yes. Thank you for clarifying that. Well, thank you for your eagle eye, Chair Pinto, and thank you for confirming the record. So with that clarification, Representative Rarick moves the approval of the April 28th minutes. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, nay. So those minutes are approved. And now today, members, we are going to have an informational hearing on Medicaid fraud, as we have talked about multiple times throughout this session, that we've wanted to get this on the calendar. And so we are grateful to have the Attorney General's office here and the Department of Human Services. I guess the Department of Human Services, when unable to send someone, because please join us at the table, because they are in negotiations trying to get us out of here on the budget. So they have sent a slide deck that's in our packets, but today we're going to hear from the Attorney General Keith Ellison and his staff, and we very much appreciate that. Then, just so you know, this is the first portion of the hearing, and then we are going to pivot to looking at the two bills that we have put together based on all the testimony we have had this session. Our committee has two committee bills that we are also going to talk about, and that will be at the end of the hearing. So just want to flag that for everyone. And with that, we welcome you to the committee, Attorney General Ellison. Please state your name for the record, and you can begin your testimony.
Good morning, Chair Robbins, Vice Chair Anderson, and DFL Lead Pinto, and members of the committee. As you know, my name is Keith Ellison, and I serve the residents of the state of Minnesota as Attorney General of the state of Minnesota. Thank you for inviting my office to give a presentation on the Medicaid Fraud Control Unit. I'm always proud to share the work happening at the Minnesota Attorney General's office and the work they're doing to help Minnesotans every day. I'll be turning the presentation over to Nick Wonka, who's seated to my left. He's the director of the Medicaid Control Fraud Unit, and to John Keller, our Chief Deputy Attorney General. But I want to set a stage for the presentation that you're about to hear. As you'll hear multiple times today, I'm sure that in Minnesota and until and unless the legislature sees fit to expand our authority, the Attorney General's office has original jurisdiction to bring a criminal case against someone in only one area of work, Medicaid fraud. Our investigators and prosecutors are good at what they do. They spend 100% of their time investigating and prosecuting Medicaid provider fraud and the abuse, neglect, and financial exploitation of vulnerable adults residing in certain settings. The work of this unit is a great value for Minnesota in terms of the state budget. Each one of these units is funded by a federal grant from the Department of Health and Human Services Office of Inspector General. That grant covers about 75% of our funding. The state pays the remaining 25%. And for the 25% match, the state gets a great return on investment. Over the past 5 years, Minnesota has only spent about $5 million on our Medicaid control unit. In that same time, the unit won $53 million in restitution and recoveries. But I want to emphasize that the greatest value of this unit, far greater than any budgetary value, is the work they do to protect Minnesotans from being defrauded, from being exploited, and most importantly, holding those who abuse, neglect, and exploit vulnerable Minnesotans accountable. And with that, I'll turn it over to Nick Wonka and John Keller. I do have a schedule this morning, so I will excuse myself at this time, Madam Chair, but thank you for having us.
Thank you for taking the time to come, Attorney General. We appreciate it. We appreciate your work of your team. Thank you.
We're going to work on an HDMI issue, and I will start shortly.
Thank you. Is someone from our tech team helping you? Sierra, is she available?
Just plug it into the other
HDMI. Okay. She'll come to the rescue. She's fantastic.
Perfect.
Meanwhile, members, I just want to draw attention to things that Department of Human Services sent in your packet. So there is, and this is available online for anyone watching, there is a list of Medicaid medical assistance eligibility requirements. And then there's a small slide deck from the Department of Administration. And I believe there's also the income affordability guidelines for MA from the Department of Human Services. So I think all of those will be helpful in our discussion. Great.
It's so, not been solved, but we'll just go off. You all have paper copies, right?
You all have paper copies, and they are also available online. So we'll look forward to your presentation. Please start by stating your name for the record.
Sure. Good morning. I'm Nick Wonka, N-I-C-K-W-A-N-K-A. I'm the director of Minnesota's Medicaid Fraud Control Unit, which is housed in the Attorney General's office. And before I begin discussing who we are and what we do, I want to thank you all for inviting me here today. Medicaid fraud is a critically important topic. And it's great to see you all discussing these issues and possible solutions in a public setting like this. Ensuring that the taxpayer dollars you dedicate to providing critical health care services to Minnesota's most vulnerable people actually go to that purpose and not to lining the pockets of fraudsters is among the most important functions of our state government. And I'm happy to be here today to talk to you all about what we in the Medicaid Fraud Control Unit do to hold people accountable for stealing those funds that should be going to caring for people who need it. And what can be done to help us in that shared mission that all of us have. Now, before I get into the stats and details about the things that we do and the things that we don't, I want to highlight some case examples for you to help better contextualize what it is we do on a day-to-day basis in some of the cases that we bring. As some of you already know, and as I hope all of you know when we're done today, at the direction of the federal government, we in the Medicaid Fraud Unit handle two categories of cases. Provider fraud, and what the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services calls patient abuse, which here in Minnesota is abuse, neglect, and financial exploitation of vulnerable adults. Our unit does both, and we do both well. For instance, let's talk about some of our provider fraud cases. In one example, we have a home care nursing agency. They are supposed to be providing home care nursing services to residents throughout southwest and southeast Minnesota. In some instances, that includes children under the age of 5. In other instances, it's elderly adults. But in all cases, it is people with serious medical issues. A 4-year-old boy with a feeding tube. Vulnerable adults who are non-ambulatory. people with serious medical conditions who desperately need this care. But instead of providing that care, you have the person who managed the agency stealing from the Medicaid program to the tune of $1.8 million. When that kid needed 6 hours of nursing services in a day, the manager billed for 24 hours. When that vulnerable adult needed 24 hours of care from a registered nurse, that manager billed for over 2,000 hours when she sent out an unlicensed home health aide to do work around the house, if anyone showed up at all. And when we found out, we investigated, we prosecuted, we took her to trial, and we convicted her, and we held her accountable. Then you have the mental health therapist who provides services to groups of people with every mental health condition you could think of. These are people from all backgrounds, some from war-torn areas of the world, some from right around the corner from his office in Anoka, all of whom are struggling with their mental health. And rather than providing it and giving them what they need, what did he do? Well, he'd bill for services he wasn't providing. He'd sit in a group session with six people, then bill Medicaid as if he provided individual services to eight. He helped unlicensed therapists open a new clinic where instead of providing mental health services, they had people stop by to drink tea, then be transported home after a couple minutes. And at the end, his enterprise defrauded Medicaid of well over $1 million. And he was found guilty and held accountable for that, too. And as I also mentioned, we do what we call patient abuse and neglect cases. And these are some of the most heart-wrenching that we see. Cases that we get from county attorneys who ask for our help. For example, one that came out of Chippewa County, Montevideo. An elderly woman whose son is supposed to look after her finances as the conservator. She's in the last few years of her life living in a nursing home and sitting on hundreds of thousands of dollars in her accounts and in family farmland. What does her son and daughter-in-law do? Well, they don't take care of her. Her nursing home bills don't get paid. She doesn't have personal needs money to buy basic things like socks, toiletries, toothbrushes. Her farmland that was worth hundreds of thousands of dollars gets deeded over by her son to his wife for less than $500. And when her nursing home bills go unpaid, she no longer has a place to live. She's evicted, $72,000 in the hold of the nursing home. Meanwhile, the son and daughter-in-law make away with the money. They take her debit card to dog shows in other states, spend thousands of dollars at places like Hot Topic and Walmart. She passes away in squalor. We took that case from Chippewa County after the county attorney asked us to, and we held them accountable, just like we've done with other counties. There's the representative payee who stole over $50,000 from Social Security beneficiaries he was supposed to be taking care of. 25 separate people whose funds he was supposed to safeguard because they were incapable of handling their own money. People in memory care units who counted on him to do that. 25 people who lost their money so this guy could spend it away at places like Running Aces. We took that case from the Chisago County attorney asked us to. We took it to trial, and we held him accountable as well. And if you pay attention to the news out of central Minnesota, you'll hear about another case we're prosecuting later this week. It's about a mom who's about to go on trial for some of the most horrific medical child abuse our state has ever seen. She did that while also defrauding the Medicaid program about the care she was providing to her kids. That case came to us after the Crow Wing County attorney asked us to, and we have two great prosecutors who are about to go on trial in Brainerd this week to hold her accountable. And those are just some small examples of the cases we prosecute in the Medicaid Fraud Control Unit and the work that we do every day. And now that you have some examples of the work we've done, here's a little bit about who we are. Our Medicaid Fraud Control Unit has existed for over 40 years. We're one of 53 in the country. Every state has one, as do D.C., Puerto Rico, and the U.S. Virgin Islands. We're a law enforcement entity in the sense that we investigate and prosecute our own criminal and civil cases. We have 32 people on staff that are comprised of attorneys, investigators, analysts, paralegals, and legal support staff. Each one of us is funded by a federal grant from the Department of Health and Human Services Office of Inspector General. That grant covers 75% of our funding and comes with conditions on what we can and cannot do. It requires us to spend 100% of our time investigating and prosecuting Medicaid provider fraud and the abuse, neglect, and financial exploitation of vulnerable adults residing in certain settings. The Office of Inspector General also frequently issues policy guidance to MFUCUs, and that guidance is public and posted on OIG website about what we do and what we're supposed to be doing. And what we can and can't do with the money the federal government gives us is covered by federal regulations. We can investigate and prosecute Medicaid provider fraud, and as you've heard, we have concurrent jurisdiction under Minnesota law to do that. And we can investigate crimes that arise out of the same set of circumstances, certain ones, most often of which are other financial crimes like money laundering and identity theft. So that's how we do those cases against the home care nursing agency manager, or the mental health therapist, or the PCA services agency owner who's federally excluded because of a prior conviction for Medicaid fraud, yet then finds straw owners to run their companies on paper, does the same scheme they did before, and steals millions of dollars from the taxpayers. And we can also do patient abuse and neglect cases if the victim either resides in a facility that received Medicaid funds, like a nursing home, or if they're abused by a provider who is providing services to them in the victim's own home. And as I mentioned, we do lack original jurisdiction for these, but we take them on referral from county attorneys. As you heard some small examples of, these are some of the saddest and most heart-wrenching cases that we investigate and prosecute. Finally, we assist other law enforcement agencies when they request it. We regularly work with our law enforcement partners at the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Office of Inspector General, the FBI, and the Commerce Fraud Bureau, which is now the State Fraud Unit at the BCA. They're all fantastic partners, and when we work together, we're able to bring great cases that hold fraudsters accountable. But as has been mentioned, with the federal grant and federal requirements come certain prohibitions, too. For instance, there's just certain cases we can't use federal funds to investigate or prosecute, and certain activities that we can't do. We can't do recipient fraud, for example, fraud in obtaining benefits. We can't do other crimes that may arise out of the same set of circumstances. For instance, if we execute a search warrant at a healthcare company and find drugs or guns, which you may not think would happen, but has, we send that to local law enforcement to bring the county attorneys. And last, our federal regulations require us to be entirely separate from the agency that administers the Medicaid program, which here is DHS. So we can prosecute it, but we can't turn off payments on the front end or bar a certain provider from enrolling with Medicaid or continuing to receive payments. We also can't investigate or prosecute, as I mentioned, fraud in obtaining benefits or through other public programs. So there's some examples of cases in your handout that we've done on different provider types. You'll see that they cover really anybody who could be a Medicaid provider, from licensed professionals to home care agencies to other treatment providers. In other words, if someone's a Medicaid provider, they're within our ambit. Now, how do we get our cases? Well, they come from different sources, but the most common is the Department of Human Services, whose Medicaid Provider Audits and Investigations Division refers them to us after they conduct their own administrative investigations. We also get a lot of our cases from managed care organizations and their Special Investigations Unit. Those SIUs, the acronym for Special Investigations Unit, investigate provider fraud at MCOs, and they send us referrals that we then investigate and prosecute. We also get cases from other law enforcement agencies, other state agencies, like the Department of Health, whose team surveys nursing homes and assisted living facilities, and the tips we get from the public. And our team is housed with investigators and prosecutors from a number of different backgrounds. We have former assistant county attorneys and former law enforcement officers, like you'd probably expect. We also have people from a number of other disciplines. For instance, for attorneys, we have skilled civil litigators who handle our False Claims Act cases. And our staff includes multiple levels of investigators as well. We have a supervising investigator who manages them and does a fantastic job at it. We have an auditor that's required by our federal regulations. We have lead investigators, who are some of our most experienced people and do our most complex cases. Nurse investigators, who put a lot of time into our abuse and neglect cases. We have a lead analyst who does things in Excel that, quite frankly, I couldn't explain to you without bringing them in here myself. And our staff comes from a variety of backgrounds, some that I mentioned you may expect, like former law enforcement officers, but other backgrounds as well. Staff who previously investigated healthcare fraud at private insurance or other state agencies. Former military members who served as military police and now investigate crimes for us in the civilian world. Former financial fraud investigators who can review and follow money. But those are just some examples of the talented team that we have that, like every other Medicaid fraud unit throughout the country, dedicates all their time and effort to protecting program integrity and vulnerable populations by holding fraudsters and abusers accountable. Now, our size of 32 is set by the federal government. And as I mentioned, they pay 75% of our cost, while the state pays 25%, so it's a pretty good deal for Minnesota. Each Medicaid fraud unit size is based on the size of its state Medicaid budget. So California has a much bigger Medicaid budget, they're going to have a much bigger Medicaid fraud control unit. And based on our state Medicaid budget, our size is supposed to be 41. But it's not. It's still at 32. And it hasn't grown like our state Medicaid budget has over the last 5 years. And as you can see from our slides, when our state Medicaid budget is expanded, our Medicaid fraud unit has not. And our state Medicaid fraud unit has a smaller staff size than other Medicaid fraud units with similar Medicaid budgets. Again, this the handout shows, with the exception of Missouri, other states with a similar size Medicaid budget outpace us, and in some cases, fairly significantly. So you can see from Virginia, for example. But even with that, we get results. We regularly outpace other states in the number of fraud convictions and charges we get and bring. And this included 2024, when we had 58 provider fraud charges, which was fifth in the country. When you ask what you could do to help us, I'll say as a first step, it's to pass the Medical Assistance Protection Act. That will allow us not only to grow as we should be in line with the recommendations with the federal government, but it will also implement the policy changes. We aren't asking for more people just to keep pace right now. The funding attached to that bill will get us to 41 people, which is where we should be based on the federal government's recommendation. And the policy change will be helpful to our prosecutors and investigators too. Right now, the current version of the medical assistance fraud statute has gaps and it has insufficient penalties when compared to other financial crimes. For instance, the current fraud statute, the way that it's written, only applies to claims submitted to the state agency, not to MCOs. Now, we still prosecute fraud against MCOs, don't worry about that, we've done that for years, but we have to use other statutes to do it, and those aren't as articulate or clear as the statute in the MAP Act would be. This statute, as I mentioned, is drafted by the prosecutors who go into court every day and fight to hold fraudsters accountable, and enacting it will help them in their efforts to do just that. And finally, there's some other provisions, most prominently increased subpoena authority when the Medicaid fraud unit is conducting provider fraud investigations. This would give us the same power that county attorneys have when they conduct welfare fraud investigations. No more, no less. Investigating agencies conducting provider fraud investigations should have the same power as those conducting beneficiary fraud investigations, and that's what this would do. So you brought me here today to answer a number of questions, and like I said, thank you for doing that. I'm happy to be here. But before I do, I'd just like to make a couple things clear as possible. First, I'm not going to be discussing ongoing or active investigations or specific investigative techniques we use. That includes even confirming whether a particular provider is under investigation. And I don't mean to be disrespectful, but I'm not going to jeopardize the integrity of any ongoing investigations today because that isn't fair to the investigators and prosecutors working on the case. And it's quite frankly not what any of you want to happen either, I would imagine. Your hearings are public, and as they should be, and I don't want to give any fraudster tuning in any advantage over our investigators. Next, I'm more than happy to talk about fraud indicators and what we see as high-risk providers. But I will couch the high-risk providers with a caveat as well. I can only talk about the cases that we see, which is those that are referred to us by various different sources. We in the Medicaid fraud unit, as I've said, are the investigators and prosecutors. But we don't have access to the same source data that some of our working partners like DHS and managed care organizations have. We don't have real-time access to claims data submitted by healthcare providers. We don't have real-time access to payment information to the point that we can run queries on what providers are being paid the most in different intervals, or which providers have seen the largest jump in their reimbursements in the past 6 months, or things like that. Because we're the criminal prosecutors, we have to get that information either from our working partners or gather it through constitutionally sufficient means like search warrants. So if you ask me about high-risk providers, I'm going to be able to talk to you about what we've seen and what our view is, but that's going to be necessarily restricted by the more limited information that we have as compared to some other people. So with that, I look forward to your questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. I'm sure we have a number of questions. I'm going to lead off. First of all, thank you for that overview of what your agency does and for the work of your team. You have had success in prosecuting Medicaid fraud, and we're very grateful for that. I appreciate a discussion of the bill that's currently working its way through the process and how that would help your team. I think first I would just like to talk about this access to real-time data. Is that part of that proposal?
No, it is not. There are certain restrictions that come from federal law on what we can and can't access through DHS. There is a deliberate scheme that was enacted by Congress when they set up Medicaid fraud units that we would be entirely separate from them. That's why we don't have that.
But if you do get a search warrant, are you able to get real-time access, or is it still subject to
It's going to be delayed. I mean, we can send over a request to DHS and say, hey, can you give us all the claims submitted by this provider for the last year? And if we were to send it today, May 5th, right, we may say everything up through May 5th, and they'll send us everything up through May 5th, but we won't get it going forward on an ongoing basis, if that makes sense.
Yes. And so is that something that you are working with our federal delegation on, or is that
I don't know that there's an interest in Congress in changing all of these Medicaid fraud regulations right now. You know, Medicaid fraud, a change to us is going to affect all 53 of us. There are provisions that could theoretically allow it through what's called a data mining waiver. That is contained in federal law, and that's something that we internally have to work with the Office of Inspector General on, and we've had those conversations with them and other Medicaid fraud units throughout the country who have obtained that data mining waiver. There's a lot of minutia to that. I'm not going to get into it today.
Sure,
but
right.
But yeah, there's a provision in the federal regulations for something called a data mining waiver. It wouldn't give us identical access, particularly it doesn't cover payment information that would be held by another agency. But if we look at real-time data, it wouldn't be a perfect substitute for it. But what it would allow us to do is go in and say, hey, this provider of housing stabilization services, right, just picking one that was in the news, please give us the highest billed providers of this for the last 2 years. That would be necessary through a data mining waiver for our investigators to go in and look at it themselves.
Thank you. And just one more follow-up before I get to my colleagues. So if you can't have access to that data, does DHS regularly look for those flags?
That's a question for DHS. I mean, I can't talk about and I'm not trying to be cagey. I don't know how they conduct their own internal data mining. What I can tell you is that if we ask them for something like that, they will get it to us.
Okay. And would that be something where, as you know, both the governor and the legislature are looking at inspector general, creating an inspector general office that might have that oversight and can work between agencies and among agencies? Would that be a type of authority you think we could potentially house in an inspector general office, or would you support something like that?
I would have to look more at the federal regulations. I will tell you that there are a number of other states, as you know, that have inspector generals.
Yes.
What they do with that data would probably be similar to what we could do under federal law. I can't speak to state law, but that's something that I would need to look at the actual regulations and have them in front of me to give you that appropriate answer.
Great. Well, I appreciate that. And perhaps, you know, the people working on that IG bill could follow up, because I think the more that we're looking at the whole enterprise and having agencies talk to each other and flag these different anomalies, it's, you know, going to help us get ahead of this in different areas. So thank you.
I agree with that. Thank you.
Thank you. So with that, Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just on this subject, actually, I just wanted to make the committee aware of things that are kind of going on in this area and in the background. So the Minute Technical Advisory Commission, which the legislature created a few years ago, has constituted a data sharing subcommittee. I'm an active member of that subcommittee, and some of these issues are under active exploration. In particular, as part of the breakup of DHS and DCYF and Direct Services, there was an extensive legal analysis of what are really the limitations on data sharing, especially related to DHS and its sister organizations. I can say that the preliminary investigation indicated that a lot of the data sharing restrictions aren't really as severe as they were imagined. I mean, we have a big problem generally with data silos in state government, but when those contracts with the federal government were examined in more detail, it was discovered that most of the contracts are with the state of Minnesota, not with DHS, for example. We're also in that subcommittee looking very closely about, you know, what would it take in order to make it easier for state government to share information of this nature. I know for me, you know, members of this committee have read lots of OLA reports this year. The one that was the most eye-opening for me was the one on the frontline worker pay. And that was because it required, in order to execute that program in about 5 months, it required, you know, deed, DLI, minute, and revenue to very quickly, within the course of 5 months, stand up an integration of the data across those sources in order to execute the program. Actually, I think, you know, in the big scheme of things, considering what they did, I thought it was pretty remarkable, and the level of fraud that resulted, which we knew there would be some, was relatively modest in terms of, you know, what the effort that was required. And I personally went back to Minute Commissioner Tarek Tomes and said, Tarek, why, this was an extraordinary effort, why can't it be ordinary? And so some of the discussions that I've been having with you know, agency IT staff with Minute, we're now kind of, you know, moving in a direction of, let's say, why can't this be ordinary? You know, well, you know, protecting the privacy of people's data. You know, a lot of it, for example, the data could rest in place where it is, but be accessible to other agencies through what are called, you know, data services, where you just make out a call to say, what is this person's income, or is this person dead or not? Does this person have a social security number, which doesn't involve lots of flying of, you know, masses of data around like is being done by DOJ right now? So it's limited, it's focused to individual cases, but you should be able to make these kind of queries, which would have a huge impact on fraud in real time. Just as the data is needed. So I think by the time we get come back together early next year, we'll probably have been way down the path to figuring out a roadmap, you know, for being able to do some of this stuff. But I'll note also that key components of that have not been funded by the legislature so far. So DHS, for example, had a proposal to stand up what's called a master data management solution. So master data management for clients, and this is something that DHS has always struggled with, is just keeping track of who are their clients, making sure that they have a single record in their system for each client. They requested that money to stand up a master data management to create a golden record of the client 2 years ago, and we didn't fund it. This year, I would note that the governor's proposal had funding to pursue artificial intelligence to scour the DHS databases for fraud, and that doesn't look like we're going to fund that this year either. So if we really, you know, want to, you know, bring the best technology to bear on some of these problems, we have to be prepared next year when we come back to step up to the plate and fund some of these things if we're really going to be serious about fraud, because it can't just be a whole bunch of arms and legs, you know, working harder to get this out, this problem under control. It's going to require some investment in IT infrastructure.
Thank you, Representative Elkins. And I agree with a lot of your comments. I've had a bill for 6 years to have an enterprise-wide grants management system put in place. And I do hope, I know many agencies are working on this, and my hope is that we actually get something that does work across the system so agencies can see providers or people that have had trouble or people that have, you know, failed in different aspects of grants management and gets flagged for other agencies. So I know a lot of agencies are looking at different aspects of data, but we need to make sure whoever is working on it in your task force and other groups that we're looking at something that we are putting money into that will work across the enterprise. So I look forward to seeing more of your work and appreciate your hard work on that. And also your concern about data protection, which I know we all share. Thank you. Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I really appreciate you all being here. I think the chair would tell you I've been saying for 2 or 3 months it would be great to hear from you, and got to hear the presentation of your bill in public safety and other places, or one of the pieces. I just wanted to clarify something, and then to get to the heart of the issue that I think we're looking at, which is like, how do we study the system of fraud? I think we're thinking about, when we think about recommendations, obviously not just asking you all, asking the agencies, asking outside investigators, asking both at the federal and the county level, but we're trying to get to, you know, there's tools we have that can deter and disrupt, and then there's tools that we have that give prosecutors and investigators the ability to find and hopefully and punish as both a deterrence but also to deal with folks with bad actors. So look, those are, we know that there's a broad range of tools. I think oftentimes in this conversation we have had conversations about policy without connecting it to what folks like you are actually seeing on the ground, and that's one of the reasons I'm really excited to have you here. One thing I just wanted to clarify, though, because I heard, I think we oftentimes conflate a lot of different things, and I am wondering, are you mostly looking at grants and grants to nonprofits? Is that something that you do?
No. Sorry, I apologize.
No, that's fine, Mr. Wonka. Please proceed.
No, we do Medicaid provider fraud, not not nonprofit grants.
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I really appreciate that, because I think when we talk about private providers and when we talk about Medicaid and private providers, there's a set of tools that are not about nonprofit grants that is a whole different thing. And I think oftentimes in this committee we conflate them, but we need to actually look at the problem we're trying to solve. So it feels like we hear a lot about overbilling, about straw owners. I want to sort of push to aside the really personal but individual cases, I think, when you talk about the neglect. But looking at what our former U.S. attorney sort of talked about, three different types of fraud. He talked about sort of the small ball, someone screws up, they accidentally get something, and then they continue to get it. He talked about sort of small, low-level systems fraud. And then he talked about, and I think this is where most of our folks have been, it's like folks who see a system and figure out how to exploit it, create government as a profit center using illegal tools. And so that's the business model of fraud that we're really looking at. And I'm wondering if you have thoughts both on where we tend to see that over and over again, but more importantly, I think, is we want to be able to understand the business model so we can look at those tools of how do we actually detect it earlier? How do we close the places that can be exploited? And more generally, like, how are we looking at folks who have built, you know, systems, whether it's straw purchasers and other things, to actually create a bigger system of fraud? I know that's a big question. I've been waiting for 3 months for you to be here. But I'm happy to make those into smaller chunks, but that's sort of where we've been thinking about.
Mr. Wonka.
Sure. I'm trying to figure out where to start with that. I mean, I think as a general matter, you know, anytime you have a new program come online, particularly if it's an unlicensed program with low barriers to entry, that's going to be ripe for bad actors to look into. Whenever a new program comes online, number one, it's probably coming online because there's been a demand for services, so you're going to see a lot of people who want to get those services. Number two, if it's an unlicensed program, it's a lot easier to sign up and start getting reimbursement sooner. And number three, sometimes there's not as much oversight of new programs initially when it comes online as there should be. And part of that can be, you know, related to how the regulations are written. If they're broad regulations and the focus is primarily, at least at first, on getting people services, then that's going to be easier to justify both the reimbursements for, and it's going to be more difficult to prosecute later or to investigate, because essentially, if you have a program where essentially, like, look, if any type of service is being provided, if someone's present with you, we're going to reimburse it. I mean, that makes it hard for us, right? For us to prosecute a case, we have to have a very firm statement that can hold up in court and that we can present a witness to in front of a jury who will say, we would not pay for this service that was delivered, right? Like, for instance, I brought up the home care nursing agency case. If you have someone who's supposed to get services from a registered nurse and you send out an unlicensed home health aide to do it, that's not going to be reimbursed. That's clear fraud, right? But you need a witness who's going to come in and say that. Whereas if you have a more murkier type of regulatory structure where, you know, that's going to be a more difficult case to both withhold payments on and to later prosecute. So I think when you have those new programs come online, that is one area. You know, for years we've had, I mean, we've had cases with all sorts of home care fraud in, within them. That's going to be another area that's going to just be ripe for abuse because it occurs in someone's home outside of the view of, you know, the general public or of any licensed professionals. So those are other areas. And, you know, one thing with respect to the home care services is particularly, you know, PCA services a number of years ago, you all put additional regulations in place on and additional statutes, one being that, you know, all PCAs have to enroll as Medicaid providers, which means that the companies have to identify the provider when they submit a claim for reimbursement. That is a good fraud mechanism in place because then if you have DHS, they can say, hey, look, this person is providing services to this client at this specific time, and they can't be billed also by another agency for providing services to another client on the same day. Those type of, that type of oversight is not present with most home care services. You don't require, for instance, providers of home and community-based services, which are waivered services, to enroll as providers. And I mean, from our perspective, there's not a good reason for that because home and community-based services reimburse at a higher rate than PCA services, but they're of a similar nature in that they're provided in someone's home and can be provided for up to 24 hours a day. And when you don't have that type of enrollment structure, it is more ripe for fraud. The same is true of other home care services. Adult rehabilitative mental health services are another one where you don't require people to enroll as providers. That's another area that we have seen quite a bit of fraud in over the years. And so that's just one example or a couple examples of areas where we see that. The home care nursing agency case, nurses aren't billed in the same way that PCAs are, and they're not enrolling the same. So, you know, and I don't want to take up, you know, the entire time talking about this minutia, but that's just one example that we see as prosecutors and investigators is an area that, you know, could really be addressed by you is to look at the enrollment requirements that you have for personal care assistants and place them on all home care providers, because that's going to go a long way to eliminating some of those things on the front end and making it easier to investigate and prosecute when there are still fraudsters who are trying to steal money.
Thank you. That was an excellent suggestion, and we look forward to all of your suggestions in that vein or other veins where you have specific things like that where we could take action. That's the kind of role that we're trying to play, to fill gaps in statute that would provide the tools for better oversight and prosecution. So thank you for that. Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, and I agree with the Chair. I have another question sort of in that vein, and, you know, not all of these services, right, when we're talking about potentially healthcare and whoever else, some of those services can't be provided by public, by government, but some of it can. Like when we're talking about some of these, they're counseling, they sound a lot like social workers that the counties or the, in some cases, the state have. Representative Anderson and I have been talking, have had a conversation about, in some cases, bringing the transparency of government-provided services may be an option. I'm wondering if in the Medicaid fraud space, if you actually have seen fraud when it comes to the kinds of things through the Medicaid system, even at the social work level, that exist that are provided by public infrastructure as opposed to private infrastructure.
Mr. Wonka.
We have investigated and prosecuted public employees before. So, does that answer your question?
Representative Goodman.
Thank you. I guess I'm asking, and that is, I think you should investigate and prosecute wherever it comes. I think what we're thinking about from a systems level is to your point about, you know, whether it's one of the things that licensing does, as you talked about, or that putting providers, is it just provides a level of transparency that we may not have into whether it's a for-profit provider or a nonprofit provider when they're not, when they're one or two steps removed from us, we don't see into that business, or we don't see into that business model. So I guess I'm asking in terms of, as we think about tools, one of the things that I feel like when we see these big numbers and these big business models of fraud, I just looking at whether you look at what we see in the news, what has come across our desk in the OLA, it seems like most of what we're talking about is private providers. And I'm wondering if there's a structural piece there or if it's just something different.
I think,
Mr. Wonka.
You know, I think that that's just the way that the Medicaid program is set up in Minnesota. You know, most of the providers are private providers. I mean, there is a public piece in the way that the services may be authorized by a public health nurse or something like that. And I mean, we've seen issues there, but it hasn't been as common, at least that's been told to us, that like we have a public health nurse who's aiding and abetting, you know, a large home care provider in defrauding the government. That's not something that we frequently see. I can't say we've never seen it, but the way that, you know, the Medicaid program works here is that most of the time, I mean, you have a private company that enrolls as a Medicaid provider and that is receiving funds and reimbursements from the government to provide those services. And that's just the way that it's structured here. So there, you know, by the way that it's structured, most of the people that we investigate and prosecute are going to be those private providers.
Thank you. Thank you. So turning to Representative Rarick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I'm really interested in the consequences, the penalties. On one of your last slides, you talked about only 2.5 years in prison is the maximum for, let's see, Medicaid fraud, I believe, and you can't do an aggregation of the value. It's the second to the last slide.
Yeah.
And I know when we've had discussions in here about Feeding Our Future, you know, those convictions were like 16 years, 17 years in federal prison, which of course federal prison is completely different than Minnesota State Prison because you serve the vast majority, 80 to 85, maybe even 90%, depending on your behavior in prison. In Minnesota, we even have now, you can serve 50%. We've got that new wonderful thing. So can you just talk just a little bit about this? Because you have this on the slide. You didn't say that it was only 2.5 years, but I read the slide and I was like pretty shocked that that's the maximum is 2.5 years for defrauding, you know, the taxpayer and the poor people that are trying to get services because we've had massive fraud in Minnesota. So I'm wondering if you could speak to that just a little bit and also the part about it doesn't contain an aggregation. So looks like you got a little pocket of money here and then you got a penalty there and you got a little pocket over here, but you can't put them together, I'm assuming is what you're referring to. Can you just speak to that just a little bit?
Yeah, so I'm speaking of Minnesota Statute 609466. That's the medical assistance fraud statute. That was enacted 40 years ago and hasn't been updated since, even though we've updated a lot of our theft statutes to be more in tune with the modern day. That statute is the way it's written. It says anyone who commits medical assistance fraud is guilty of an attempted theft of public funds. Public funds, stealing public funds is punishable in the theft statutes under 609.52 subdivision 3, parent 5. As up to 5 years in prison. An attempt crimes in Minnesota are always one half of a completed crime, so it's punishable by up to 2.5 years in prison, which is not sufficient when compared to other theft crimes. You know, and so, quite frankly, we in med fraud, you know, all of the cases that I mentioned to you, we didn't prosecute under the medical assistance fraud statute. We prosecuted under theft statutes because the medical assistance fraud statute carries these low penalties, and quite frankly, I mean, if you steal $1.8 million, you shouldn't be getting a maximum sentence of 2.5 years in prison, right? Like, that person who I mentioned got a prison sentence of 93 months. So, you know, we use other statutes to accomplish those goals right now, but the medical assistance statute that we're, you know, asking to be enacted into law would carry the same penalties as other theft offenses, but would have much better charging language as well within it. And so that's why, that's the reason we're asking for it.
Thank you. Any follow-up, Representative Rack?
Just a different question. When Attorney General Ellison was here, I believe he said you had $153 million of funds recovered, and maybe you're not sure. Maybe that wasn't the right number, but do you have a sense as to, say, in the last 2 years, 4 years, whatever number you might have, how much money you've been able to recover?
I would need
Monica.
I believe that it was $53 million in the last 5 years is what he said. As far as in the last one or two, I could get that information for you. I do not have that off the top today.
Representative Rick.
Thank you. No, that's all I need. So I misheard him then. So $53 million over the last 5 years. So approximately $10 million a year is what is recovered. And I'm wondering if you have a sense as to what you think, well, let's just say what you prosecuted, like the amount in that same period of time. I mean, that's just what you've recovered, but do you have a sense as to what was stolen?
Mr. Wonka.
Not before me today. And part of the reason is because some of our larger dollar cases are still going through the court system. You know, if we could, I mean, we could try to look up exactly the amounts that we've charged as fraud over the last few years and include that. But I don't have that information for you today, but that's something that we could gather. The way that we report our information to the Office of Inspector General, we're required to do a statistical report every single year. It's all publicly available. And so we can certainly pull information from there if you'd like.
Thank you. Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You had mentioned due to federal law, there's certain restrictions on what you can do. One of those is that you can't basically order an agency to take administrative action. I'm wondering, though, if you're able to keep lines of communication open and advise them of what you believe would be appropriate in a given situation.
Mr. Wonka.
There's no prohibition on us talking to them. And, you know, we do tell them, for instance, whenever we execute a search warrant on an agency, we send that to them so that they can review it and determine whether there is a credible allegation of fraud that would allow them to withhold payments to that provider. And that's if they don't already know that we're investigating. You know, a lot of times we will let them know, hey, we are investigating these people. There's certain information that we're going to share and there's certain information that we're going to not in an active investigation. But once there are publicly available documents like search warrants, we're just going to send them over to them so that they know this is what we found, this is what a judge has found probable cause for, and then they can take the action that is appropriate. And by state agencies here, I mean the Department of Human Services, since they're the ones who administer Medicaid.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for that answer. So that definitely gives me some follow-up questions for the next time we talk to DHS. So I appreciate it.
Just before I go to Chair Pinto, I just wanted to ask in following up to Representative Hudson. So every time you execute a search warrant, you let the agency know so that they know that there may be probable cause for fraud so that they could, in fact, stop payment. Do you know how often they act on that information?
I do not. Well, our process is if we execute what we call a premises search warrant, right? So that's a search warrant at an agency. We send a signed copy of the search warrant after it is publicly filed and has been executed to the Department of Human Services for them to take the action that they believe is appropriate. Ultimately, the determination of whether to stop payments or not rests with the state agency. We can't order them to do that. We can't tell them that. You know, there's a separate structure between us. But we send it over to them, and then they can take what action they see fit.
And would you have data on how many of those search warrants you've sent to the agency over the past, say, 5 years?
That is not one of the categories of information that we track. I mean, what I could say is that would take us a bit of time to pull together because it's just not within our natural statistical reporting system, but I mean, we keep copies of search warrants. So it would take some time, but we could probably pull it together.
Thank you. If someone would have time over, you know, the next few months to look into that, I think that would be helpful because that's a way we can follow the thread. You're doing the work, and then we're wondering what's the agency responses, and it's been hard for us to necessarily always find that. So that would be helpful. And also, you mentioned an IG report that you file yearly to Representative Rarick's question with a bunch of statistics. And I don't know if you make it available to the Inspector General at the federal level, if you could also make that available to us or show us how to find it.
Yeah, it's posted on the Office of Inspector General's website. They post statistical information for every Medicaid fraud unit in the country on an annual basis.
Great.
On the Department of Health and Human Services Office of Inspector General website, they have a lot of information about the work that all of the Medicaid fraud control units do, and it's all there.
Perfect. We look forward to looking that up as well. Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I know, I think Representative Anderson was going to follow up from Representative Greenman. I don't mind to defer to her and go after it. That was just to sort of keep us
connected. Vice Chair Anderson.
Thank you. I want to follow up for the comments that Representative Greenman had. Are you seeing more, the problem is unlicensed providers? So when we talk about public versus private is also, could be nonprofit, but public is essentially state-run, to me, state-run services, government employees, whether they're at the state level or the county or whatever. And the fraud that I have seen is within the private or nonprofit sectors that are billing generally, I think, unlicensed. So that my question is it generally unlicensed providers?
Mr. Wonka.
That you've seen the majority of the fraud?
I would say more so than licensed professionals. Yeah, I would say more so would be my sense. I mean, the reason I'm hesitating is because if you want me to give a complete answer, I'd want to run all of our stats in our system. But my sense today would be that it would be more unlicensed than licensed.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you. And unlicensed, meaning even the business unlicensed. Maybe they hire nurses or something, but it's the business or nonprofit that's
correct.
Unlicensed.
There's a number of provider types that are required to have, for instance, licensed professionals on staff. With, you know, for a lot of the home care agencies, for instance, they'll have a nurse who's required to supervise the home care workers in certain statutorily required intervals. So they'll have a licensed person on staff, but the business itself will enroll as a Medicaid provider, but like won't get, for instance, you know, a 245D license from the Department of Health, like some providers have to. Or from the Department of Human Services, they won't get a specific license. All they will do is submit provider enrollment documents. They'll sign provider agreements. They'll disclose ownership. They'll designate a biller for the agency. And then when all that happens, they'll get a provider ID number that allows them to bill the Medicaid program. They'll have to pass background checks and disclose everybody. And, you know, everybody who they disclose will have to do that too. But there isn't a dedicated and specific license that they either need to provide the services, right? Like if you own a business, that doesn't necessarily mean you have to have a particular medical background or a particular license to do that in most provider types. Does that make sense?
Thank you.
Yeah, Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Chair. Just a couple quick items. So I'm looking at the two slides with the policy change requests and just want to make sure to nail down. So a number of these, including I think the changes Representative Rarick was asking about aggregating, et cetera, are contained in my bill, HF 2603, that was proposed, I think, by the administration. And then I think that everything on these two slides is being carried in the House state government bill. I don't know if the testifiers are aware of this or if anybody else is. I just kind of want to make sure to nail down that these things that are being suggested to us are, in fact, currently moving in the House. I think the answer is yes. But I don't know if anybody has knowledge of that. It looks like maybe.
Mr. Keller.
John Keller, the chief deputy, and I heard our ledge director say yes from the Chair is over there. Good. I will rely on her.
Okay.
Thank you. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Chair. Okay, so we phoned a friend and we got that. So good. So those are covered. And then I, too, really appreciate the additional suggestions that were made. And I guess just a request is to continue to please send those to us. To have the depth of expertise that you all have is really useful to us. And so please continue to share these suggestions. I guess I just wanted to make sure it didn't pass uncommented. I'm going back a couple more slides, the MFCU results. And the fact that our state had the most provider fraud convictions compared to other similarly sized states. Interestingly, not even, we're actually right in the middle of the size there, not near the top, and yet the most provider fraud convictions. So we're really fortunate to have you all doing your work and the expertise you bring. And I guess just want to suggest, in addition to those two slides, sounds like there may be some other ideas, and please keep them coming to us because it's really, really useful to us. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Ms. Wonka, for your presentation today. So Minnesota, between federal and state dollars, it's about $18.1 billion in Medicaid. My understanding is that's every year, if I have that correctly, or at least every biennium. And so is it by year? And so when I'm considering the amount of Medicaid fraud that has been recovered, and your number being around $53 million, it personally feels a little bit small. It makes me believe from the stories that we've heard that that number is probably larger. And I know you've referenced a lot of other cases that are still pending. So I know that there's plenty of work there. But I just want to just frame up for this that, especially with where we've seen fault lines in other areas of our state agencies and the oversight that we seek to bring, I'm really curious if there is more than what we're currently going after. But to that end, I really wanted to just kind of see if you could provide for us a little bit of a understanding as to what are some of the methods that you use to detect fraud. Are those audits, are they whistleblower reports, data analytics? Do you rely upon the public to share certain, and I guess that would kind of fit within a whistleblower, but can you kind of share what methods of detection that your agency uses?
Mr. Wonka.
Yeah, I think number one, like any law enforcement entity, we rely on the trust of the public and the public reporting things to us. And if they, if the public sees something that looks amiss, right? Like if you see, some company that looks like it shuttered and, nobody's going in there or whatever. And then suddenly, you see 30 people show up one day for a very short period of time to get paychecks, and then they walk away and there's no action for another week. I mean, that's if someone sees that and they work, across the street every day, that seems like a red flag, right? And so we rely on the community and the public to report things like that to us. But the majority of the cases that we get come on referrals from the Department of Human Services or from managed care organizations. Managed care organizations are another thing that, I don't know how much that's come up, but they, just so you all know, they investigate the providers who are providing services through them, just as the Department of Human Services does in the fee-for-service model. So we get a lot of referrals from them, too, when they see providers who are defrauding the program. We do some data analytics with the restrictions I mentioned earlier. We may ask the Department of Human Services to send us, the top 20 providers, billed providers for this provider type. And then what we can do then is we can dig down and say, all right, what's this provider billed for the last few years? Are we seeing dramatic jumps? Who owns this company? Who are some of their clients? Are they receiving services from other agencies too? Are they receiving, an amount of services in a day that seems unreasonable? But really what we rely on with that data analytics work is just to give us an idea of who to look at, right? Who may be an outlier, and then we can do a deeper dive into that information. And outside of those two referral sources, we have local law enforcement agencies who may get a Medicaid case and, they may not have the resources to investigate it, or they may call, in the past, the Commerce Fraud Bureau, and then we connect with them and we do a Medicaid fraud case together. We may, we work with our federal law enforcement partners at the FBI and the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Office of Inspector General on healthcare fraud cases too. And so really, we, you know, they come from, I mean, they come from all over, and, you know, whoever wants to report to us, we're always happy to listen.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Wonka, for that answer. You know, since this this committee was established, and for my colleagues across the aisle who wish that this presentation would have happened sooner, we missed three opportunities when you weren't here at the beginning of session to have this hearing earlier in session. So I'll just mention that for the record. And so three opportunities that we could have had this in front of us. And so for our purposes here, when I talk about when this committee was established and getting up and running, ever since that time, our committee members have heard not just whistleblowers that come from within state agencies, but we've heard from the public. Like, there are people who are shining a light, and they see us in part because we're the elected, you know, representatives that sit on a committee like this, that are sharing these types of concerns. So my question back to you, especially as an office that is, you know, elected, is how accessible is your office and is your reporting process to people who have or do suspect Medicaid fraud? And how accessible is that to the public to be able to share those stories with you so that you can further investigate?
Mr. Wonka.
So what I would say with that is we have a dedicated consumer complaint department that when they receive reports of potential Medicaid fraud, they forward it to the Medicaid Fraud Division. There's a lot of information available on our website, and Mr. Keller will detail how the consumer reporting process works further. But what I can tell you is that when one comes in, it gets sent to us, and then one of our investigators will typically contact directly the person who reported it to us if they give contact information with the tip. But I'll have Mr. Keller go through the...
Mr. Keller.
Yeah, not a lot to add. Thank you, Chair and Representative Schultz. But we've previously reported on the volume. It's a very high volume of consumer complaints that we get. I believe it's around 50,000 complaints per year. One of the first things that we did as a new administration was to update the ways in which people can submit complaints. Used to be completely over the phone when we took over, and we've subsequently added an online written submission, emails. So really any way in which the public wants to contact us, they all add up to those roughly 50,000 complaints per year. It's a large group of individuals who really are our first line of hearing about really anything that's happening in the public, and it's extremely valuable to us.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So that's a lot of complaints. And when you have 32 staff, according to your presentation, are each of those complaints being given their day in the sun with the proper look into those things, or what tools do you use to at least send some level of follow-up to that level of complaint that is coming from the public? You know, and I think that that's probably why legislators hear about these things back home, is because we're the ones most accessible to them, that they know of something that is happening, and yet they feel as though even if they do report, even if they bring it to their superior, if they happen to work within some agency of government, that somehow that's not being heard, or that no action is being taken upon it. I think that that's one of the cruxes of the issues that we hope to address as a legislature, is that we're stopping fraudulent payments, that we're stopping the theft of public dollars, so that it's helping and supporting the people who need it most, but more so, and or I should say as much so, that we don't have to take from the people more in the form of taxes to pay for government services. I mean, that's one of the big issues that is before us with such a rising cost of living.
Mr. Sure. Keller.
If I could maybe clarify, the 50,000 complaints are not all Medicaid fraud complaints. They are across the board, really anything that's happening and troubling people. We do have updated systems that allow us to quantify the types, so all of our analysts will categorize, you know, what are the areas that people are complaining about. And weekly, we get a report. And as long as I can remember, since we got the new software, the top complaints are almost always landlord-tenant issues.
Thank you.
But we do, and if I could just follow up, one of the things that we are extremely proud of in that unit is that, to your point, I think, about some of the frustrations the public has, is that we do follow up and provide referrals if we can't help people. We make sure that everybody hears back from our analysts if there is something that we can do. We often get positive feedback about, you know, this is one of the only areas where people still answer the phone. So we can always do better. But I will say we'd love to have our consumer analysts and the manager come in and talk about the success that they have in providing those really critical services to the public.
Quickly, Representative Schultz.
Yes. Is there any way that you're able to quantify of the number of complaints what amount is related to Medicaid fraud?
Representative Schultz. I don't know. I can look into that and get back to you.
Thank you. That would be helpful for the entire committee. Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The first question I had was answered in response to Representative Pinto's question. Yes, we do have legislation moving. Second was we received in our printouts this morning a bunch of good stuff that wasn't received in time to post. I was wondering if staff could post the presentation, anything that was new. So I love to grab soft copies.
Yes, it's already been posted. Thank you.
Okay.
And if you wouldn't mind, I have a couple more questions. So I just wanted to kind of level set. In our work here as a committee, as Representative Greenman had said, we have tried to investigate the business model of fraud, not just the small pieces. And you've highlighted a few of those areas. But especially in the Medicaid space, it seems to be enormous. We have seen reports of $610 million of fraud over the last 5 years, and it's great you've recovered $53 million, but that's a small amount compared to the depth of the cases that are out there. And I realize some of them are still working through the process, so there may be more. But we have seen it in sober homes, autism centers, non-emergency medical transportation. We saw an situation this week where Minneapolis Public Schools had overpaid $4 million for transportation services. We've had, you know, housing stabilization. You mentioned, you know, a lot of areas in the housing stabilization piece. And I appreciate that, you know, it's Pure Recovery, it's New Way, it's Evergreen, all those type of support services for addiction treatment. So as you look out at the landscape, how can, it seems like something's popping every day. And I don't want to, and I'm sure you don't want to do whack-a-mole where it's like, oh, now we'll focus here, now we'll focus here. There has to be a better, more systemic way we can look at that. And I think some of it is the real-time data issue. One of the issues when the non-emergency medical transportation came to our attention, and believe me, I have heard all the people out there who have whistleblowed to me on this issue, and we're also looking at it. But when I called the Department of Transportation for their list of people who provide that service, and then, like you, they send something over to DHS when people are no longer eligible, but then they don't know what happens. So it seems like part of the problem is in the translation, and I appreciate that DHS isn't here, but you're sending reports to DHS. DOT is sending reports to DHS. And then the follow-up doesn't seem to be taking place, at least in time to stop the fraud. So what can we as a legislature do better, or how can we improve the follow-up? So you send a warrant, and then it's just in their hands. Is there any other follow-up from your office? I had the discussion with DOT the other day. They send real-time updates, and it doesn't seem to translate into their system. So partly it could be a technology issue. But I'm looking for ways that from, you know, we're an oversight committee, from a management perspective, we can help connect the dots of the people who are seeing these flags and then reporting back into DHS, and it seems to not be having an effect. Could you comment on what you would like to see different?
Well, I think if you're looking at this systemically from all public programs as a state, one thing that, you know, always we have questions about is if someone is an enrolled Medicaid provider who is defrauding the system and we're investigating them, do they have contracts with other state agencies? Are they billing other state agencies? We only, you know, as we've talked about, we can do Medicaid fraud. We can't do other things. But there are other law enforcement agencies that can do other things. However, I'm, you know, a centralized, some kind of centralized database where you can punch in a person's name. And we've done a search warrant at, you know, their healthcare agency. We have probable cause to believe a crime is being committed. Well, if we can go into a database and put in that person's name or that person's taxpayer ID, something like that, and say, oh, they're also billing these other state agencies, we should let them know too. We would be happy to do that. We would be happy to let the state fraud unit at the BCA know about that as well if they're not jointly working the case with us. But we don't have access to that. I'm not aware of a database, something like that, existing. And I think if you're looking at this systemically and you want to take a view, you know, for all state agencies, I think something like that where there's a central point where someone like us who only investigates Medicaid fraud can talk to, you know, a person who can say, oh, you're investigating them for Medicaid fraud. Well, they have state contracts with these other agencies too. Please let them know what you're investigating. We can talk to them, and, like, that's not going to get us in trouble with, you know, our federal grant or anything. And we can tell those agencies, hey, you should be looking into this person. Maybe you want to do an administrative audit of them because we're investigating them for Medicaid fraud. I think if you can look at something like that, that would be a very, very good first step.
Excellent. I appreciate that because that's one of the components of HF 2891 we will be talking about in the next section of this hearing, where we would create a sort of a debar list or a suspension list where people across the agencies are all reporting into the OGM, and then that can be accessible to everyone. And if your fraud control unit could also, right now we don't have it incorporated in the language, but that you would be willing to put into that system if we get it created, where you've executed search warrants so that people are also aware of what you're finding, I think that would help strengthen the system.
Thank you. Yeah, I will say we would want, for any time there's a pending investigation, we would want some sort of private reporting structure so we know that if we report into it, it's not going to be publicly shared with, you know,
absolutely,
the general public, like other absolutely state agencies, so they can take whatever action to cut off payments. Great. That's what we want. But we don't want to be airing every detail of our investigation in public while it's occurring.
Yes, so, of course, we understand that. And we would work closely to make sure the language suits your needs. But I do think that's a huge part of the problem we're seeing, where people are reporting, and it seems to hit a wall in different agencies. And I think that's a role that our group can play. So, Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Chair. A couple things. I want to correct a misstatement that I heard earlier about the committee having heard from whistleblowers and members of the public. I think that may be true for individual members of the committee. The committee itself has not heard from anybody. I know that the chair and I have had conversations. Folks have contacted the chair, and it sounds like she's doing a lot of vetting and examining things. But so far, nothing has risen to the level of sort of being ready to be shared. So when I hear from the testifiers that you're receiving, even to the extent that there are Medicaid complaints and a portion of those 50,000, I'm assuming that what you're doing is the same thing the chair is doing, which is you are evaluating as complaints come in and you're examining them for credibility and for actionability, et cetera. But this committee has not actually heard anything itself. We've had a series of presentations, which is good, and that's been helpful. This has been especially helpful. I guess I'm also just trying to get my head around, Chair, you made a comment about this work doesn't seem to be having an effect. And I think we do want to be careful about making conclusory statements that are not necessarily backed up by specifics. We want to make sure that we are getting specific and concrete. So, for example, We have, the AG's office has said that they send all search warrant information to DHS. I think we don't want to make an assumption about what happens, because in fact, from the, looking into this that I've done, DHS withholds payments. We should ask this, of course, when they're in front of us, but withholds payments, stops making payments when in fact there's been a search warrant that's been issued. So, I think it's easy in this space to sort of say, oh, there's a lot going on and things don't seem to be having an effect. In fact, there have been multiple years of work done to do the kind of, if somebody is found to have committed wrongdoing in one space, to prevent them from receiving funds in other spaces. I'm concerned, I guess, about saying, making these broad statements when in fact we don't have the concrete information presented through multiple months. It's true, right, where there were several weeks where folks were denying quorum for a number of reasons, trying to protect the integrity of elections. It's true the state constitution, there was a, and I only bring this up, Reverend Schultz, because it was brought up by you, the state constitution was violated. We're now back together. We're trying to work together. We've had multiple months of this committee, and what I want to make sure we do is get concrete, and today has been a great example of doing that. So thank you, Chair, and thank you to the AG staff for your fabulous work. I want to make sure that we're really looking, rather than simply saying, well, there's fraud out there, things are not having an effect. Actually, there's incredible public servants doing a lot of powerful work, and we are then called on as a legislature to give you the tools to help you do more of that work. We've done that over the last few years, and our state government bill contains more to do that, and let's keep on looking at it together. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Pinto. And I would note for the record, we've talked a lot about the work of this committee, and I just want the public to understand, yes, we missed the first 3 weeks of session. We are a committee, the only committee in the state, in the legislature, that meets only once a week. And of the months we have been meeting, once the our colleagues came back to the legislature, three of those Mondays, which are our committee days, were holidays. So we've had very limited opportunity to meet, and we have been vetting the whistleblowers who come forward to us. But I have to say, as you well know, it's very challenging to bring whistleblowers forward to the public. And in some cases, when we've met with whistleblowers, we have immediately turned it over to the U.S. Attorney or the FBI. And once we've done that, we are not able, for investigative reasons that we all want to protect, to find out what's going on with those cases. But the most egregious cases, we have taken significant action on and passed on to law enforcement partners. And then we're continuing to meet with others, and we hope to be able to bring them to the committee in the interim and have those discussions, because it is very illuminating to understand what they see. And to your point, some of them are the managed care organizations who see this fraud in real time. And they have reported up the chain in their best way, but it has not always been, they haven't heard back necessarily, not necessarily to you, but to others. And so we've become a portal where people can come, and I appreciate that role that the committee is playing. And to the chair's point, we're also working hard on various strands of legislation that through all these hearings, we have brought forward to the public and learned for ourselves the gaps in statute that we're continuing to work on. And I hope that we get a lot of that over the finish line. But the work of this committee will continue in the interim. With that, we do have another question from Representative Rarick. And then, at, just so you know, we are going to pivot to the bill presentation at 10 o'clock, just so everyone knows.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So then I'll just be very, very brief. So just a couple quick things. I was looking at one of your slides, and it says you it's a $20 billion annual budget, which my colleague referenced. And we had unemployment insurance in here from Deed. And it was interesting, that presentation, they talked about a very, very low rate of fraud, which was 1.4%. So if you only think there's, I mean, I don't know what you think, but I'm just saying, if there's only 1% fraud in a $20 billion budget, that's $200 million. I just want to emphasize how important it is to catch it on the front end, not the back end, right? And so we've talked about this, and that's something that U.S. Attorney, former U.S. Attorney Lugar talked to us. We had a very long meeting with him off, not here, but personally, talked about how important it is to catch it before it's happening or as it's happening to stop it, right? And so just those numbers alone, that's potentially $200 million annually of fraud out of Medicare, if that's a really, really low number. So unemployment insurance, which of course has got incredible levels of administration, and so they catch a lot of things. I don't know if you're familiar with how that operates, but it's it's very hard to take money out of unemployment insurance fraudulently. It's a very difficult way to get money. So anyway, so if it's only 1%, that's 200 million, you were able to recover approximately 10 million. So that's 5% of that. So the recovery is incredibly difficult, incredibly expensive. And so my question though is, you talked a little bit more about the penalties, and in your proposal, you asked for an increase of the 2.5 years. You're using the theft statutes now, so what exactly have been the penalties and the sentencing? Because you haven't really talked about the sentencing. So it's probably more than 5 years, I'm assuming, but can you just talk about that just a little bit?
Mr. Wonka.
Are you asking for generally what the sentencing guidelines prescribe? Okay. So the theft statutes provide that if more than $35,000 is stolen within a six-month period of time, there's a maximum penalty of 20 years or a $100,000 fine or both. That's the maximum. As you all know, Minnesota is a sentencing guidelines state. Under the Minnesota sentencing guidelines, if someone has no criminal history and they are convicted of one count of theft of over $35,000, the penalty is a stayed 21-month prison sentence. As you get more criminal history, that goes up. But that is the maximum penalty for someone who has no criminal history. It's a severity level 6 offense under the guidelines. The next increment goes down. $35,000 is the maximum, is the highest threshold. So if you steal $35,001 or you steal $3.5 million, I mean, there's aggravated sentencing provisions that prosecutors can use, and we use those too. But by statute, it's the same charge. The next offense is a theft over $5,000. That's a maximum penalty of 10 years in prison. The fine I would have to look up, but that is a severity level 3 offense. That is a stayed prison sentence of 1 year and 1 day. And then after that, it is a theft over $1,000. That is a maximum penalty of 5 years in prison. And that is a stayed prison sentence of 1 year and 1 day. It is a severity level 2 offense under the sentencing guidelines.
Representative Rick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So again, to the point where we had the Feeding Our Future folks, and that's why I believe they took it federally, because one of them was sentenced to 17. I think the other one was sentenced to 16 years. And you just heard that, you know, Minnesota, we're not that serious about punishment. And so... So if you've got somebody that hasn't been caught before, they have a stayed sentence. Federally, 16 years, 17 years in prison. Huge difference. So our statutes really need work.
Thank you, and I'm sure you will work on that with your colleagues on the Judiciary Committee next year. So I would like to give the testifier just a closing comment, but I'm sorry, Representative Anderson, real quick.
I'll be quick. Two things, not a question. The OIG bill, both the House and the Senate version, the House, which has been held hostage in state gov for a month, but hopefully we'll get moving out of there, actually has enough provisions that they'll act as an aggregator on these things. So both versions do. So I think we're going to be good for that. But I would like... us to ask for a list of from DHS of providers that are unlicensed, not individual providers, but types, because I think a lot of this is Medicaid expansion dollars. And what programs do we have in the state that are essentially being run by unlicensed providers or non-government, should we say, entities? Because I think that's where the fraud is, and I think it's good for us to understand what that is and how large those programs are. So that's it. Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Representative Anderson. And I did send an email request on that, and they sent a reply, but I think there's more we're going to get on that. But I'll make sure the committee gets everything DHS has already sent me on that, because I do think from previous hearings we've had that areas of Medicaid expansion seem to be where a lot of this fraud is occurring. So that's something we need to take a look at. With that, Representative Elkins, very quickly.
Creating a standalone database that people manually report in assemble it meaningfully to bring to bear on this problem.
Thank you. So we appreciate your testimony. We appreciate the work of the Medicaid Fraud Unit at the Attorney General's office. And we just encourage you to continue to support the legislative changes you've asked for. We need to get those over the finish line this year. And also, you know, I'll do some follow-up with you on some of the specific things we talked about pursuing. And we also may have some specific questions about. One of my specific questions is I went on your website, did a deep dive this weekend, and all the different charges that you've brought in Medicaid fraud, and there are a lot, but it's hard for us. You announce all these charges, it's great, and sometimes there are conviction announced, but it's hard to see this has been charged, this was convicted, or this wasn't convicted. So to see the disposition of everything. So if you could help either educate us on how to better track that, or if you could consolidate that so it's easier for legislators and the public to track, because there's all these announcements all the time about charges, but then following the thread and seeing what actually has happened. And to Representative Rarick's point, if everyone's getting a state sentence, how many repeat people are in there? And that would be really helpful for us to know, you know, if someone was, it's, they've never had a conviction before, then they get the state sentence, but then they go back to the same business model of fraud under a different name. How often are you seeing that? Because that's a big concern of this committee. So we appreciate your time. If you have any last thoughts for us, we'd love to hear it.
No, I just want to thank you all again for bringing me here and for your interest in the topic. It's really good to have these conversations in the public and out in the open, how we can all work together to prevent Medicaid fraud and to hold the people who do defraud the system accountable in the way that they should be. So thank you for having me. Thank you for your time and your interest.
Thank you. And with that, I'll turn it over to Representative Anderson while I go to the testifier table.
Yeah, I don't need that. Hi, do you want me? All right. I'll even bring this.
Okay. You're the chair.
Thank you.
Thank you. We have two bills up next, and I think we'll start with the House File 3043. Chair Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members. As you know, this committee has heard from a number of agencies over the last several months where we've learned things about how we can strengthen statute and close up some gaps that would make the agencies more accountable. And we are the Minnesota Fraud and State Agency Oversight Committee, so part of our role is to hear from all of the agencies and then provide the statutory changes that they are requesting to be able to do a better job of managing the grants and the federal programs that the state administers. So HF 3043 comes out of that work, and I'm sure you will all remember, because I think we were all stunned when the testifier said that because there's no state crime for kickbacks, that's something they want, even though, to be clear, agencies can stop payment when there's credible allegations of fraud. They didn't see kickbacks to rise to the level of credible allegations of fraud that would require them to stop payment, and they requested that we get a state crime for kickbacks, or, as we're saying in the bill, illegal remunerations. So our committee bill, which I hope we will get bipartisan support for, is 3043. And it is moving in different pieces. The governor had a similar bill or a similar kickback provision. And there is language moving in the HHS bill right now, which I'm grateful for. But I wanted us to discuss this as a committee. And hopefully, as it moves forward in the HHS bill, I'm hoping that we can strengthen it, because the HHS bill does not contain the portion of our bill that would deal with kickbacks for grants. So they have stuck to federal programs, and I appreciate that. But as we have seen in testimony and in many of the things that the, if you look at the Office of Attorney General, a lot of the Medicaid things are kickbacks that are run by small businesses or nonprofits that are providers. And so that's a gaping hole in the current language that's moving forward. So with that, I would just stand for any questions about the bill, or we can move on to the next one.
Thank you. Is there anyone here from the audience that would like to testify? Okay, seeing none. Are there any questions for Representative Pinto? Chair Pinto.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Chair. Just confirming, so the Subdivision 2, yeah, I think is in the Human Services budget bill in a slightly different version. It was originally, the administration proposed it, so it's in the larger administration package that I'm the author of, HF 2603, and then I think Representative Curran actually was then the author of the bill. And so maybe just confirming, that Subdivision 2 generally matches what is currently moving in Human Services budget. Is that right?
Yes, so it is. I checked over the weekend. Oh, sorry, Vice Chair Anderson. I checked over the weekend and I got copies of what's moving in the language in the Human Services bill, and I appreciate it, and I want to make sure that stays on track. But I think because it's missing the piece about grants, that's a place where we could strengthen it. And I'm certainly prepared to have that conversation on the floor and would love to have your support for that.
Okay, Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chair Robbins, yeah, so that's the thing I guess I'm trying to think through, this Subdivision 3 then, which is the new piece. And as I understand it, there's nothing like this in federal law. Obviously, federal government has a lot of grants. Maybe I'll confirm that with Mr. Johnson with House Research if I can. There's no kind of analog otherwise in federal law to this.
Chair Robbins?
Yes, I would love to hear from Mr. Johnson, but that is my understanding.
Okay.
Mr. Johnson?
Madam Chair, members, that is essentially correct. Obviously, any theft of government funds is different. The issue often with what people refer to as a kickback is it is not always easy and clear to tie the specific action or the specific benefit to an actual theft or use or misuse of public funds. To my knowledge, there's nothing specifically like this in federal law.
Okay, thank you.
Follow-up?
Yeah, I do. Thank you, Chair. I maybe should just clarify, as my understanding from earlier, so kickbacks can be charged under state law, and they currently are. It's just that they have to be done under the theft statute, which makes it very clunky, for lack of a better word, which is why the administration proposed in the first place to have the Subdivision 2, which, again, is great. So Subdivision 3, I mean, I'll be eager to – I know this bill is in the possession of the Public Safety Committee. I'll be eager to have it – give the bill a review and hearing, because I'm just concerned, I guess, about the phrasing in Subdivision 3 and how kind of vague it is, I guess. So if somebody is employed involved in grant work as part of their job, I guess I get worried that their conduct would in fact be captured under this. If you kind of compare Subdivision 3 and Subdivision 2, you'll see it's just much more sort of general and vague. It would give prosecutors a really massive amount of discretion. You know, so a person who receives employment in return for awarding a grant, even just phrasing it that way, I receive employment in return for awarding a grant, or I recommend that an agency award a grant. So if somebody's writing a recommendation letter, and I know this is kind of stretching things, but this is how we have to think in the public safety world, I worry that the phrasing of this is quite broad. So again, I'll be eager. I do think this will need review by the Public Safety Committee, which has the official possession of it. Obviously, our committee doesn't, just to really tighten the language and review it in that way and make sure that it really works. Because I am just worried about how broadly this is written, that it would capture some folks who are actually not, and there's no, you know, the word, there's false information in Clause 3, but there's not sort of a wrongfully or that sort of thing, which often there is. I just would want to tighten the language quite a bit and examine that.
Chair Robbins.
Thank you, Chair Pinto. I appreciate that, and I look forward to working with you on the language. And just so the members and the public know, we drafted these bills after the many first hearings we had with various agencies, and we sort of collected all the suggestions the agencies gave us. And I didn't get the bills back from the reviser until April 2nd, and then they were posted on April 7th, which was deadline day. So that is why we're having an informational hearing, but some pieces of the language are moving in other bills, and I do look forward to working on that. On that specific question, just so you know about why the awarding a grant is in there.
Yeah.
So there are specific examples I could cite and that have been in the news where someone who had grants management authority and awarded contracts then later became an employee of a particular company they had awarded a grant to. And so I agree we need to perhaps tighten the language, but when someone has direct ability to award a grant and then quickly becomes an employee of that operation, I think that's something we all want to be sure we're being careful about. So that is why, you know, that's the situation we were trying to get in, where people were leveraging their authority over grant awarding for their own personal gain.
And if I can,
thank you, Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Chair Robbins, I could imagine that situation might be especially well covered, and I think it may be, in fact, currently. If it's not, we should make sure that it is. In ethical guidelines, in policy, it sounds like that may have been a state employee you're describing, and so, you know, that's something where we'd want to make sure that there are those sorts of guidelines. I guess, as a prosecutor, I get worried when we bring in, I mean, these are all felonies. When we turn it into a criminal law, we just want to make sure we have very specific language to sort of capture, because not all concerning conduct is criminal conduct, right? We still want to make sure even concerning conduct doesn't happen, but it may be that there's sort of a better way to get at it. And so I'll look forward to continued conversations with you about this. I know it has been challenging this session, bringing bills together and pieces together. The reviser's been very busy, et cetera. But I'm glad at least there's the consensus on Subdivision 2, and it is moving in the bill, and then look forward to continued review on Subdivision 3. Thank you. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Are there any further questions from any members? Chair Robbins, would you?
Thank you. Well, now I'd like to turn to HF 2891, also for informational purposes. And members, this bill comes out of all the other hearings we had, particularly early in session, where we heard from the Office of Legislative Auditor, we heard from the Office of Grants Management on ways that we could do some of the things that we actually just heard about from the Medicaid Fraud Control Unit Director, Mr. Wonka, about the need for a centralized place to have people report businesses or grantees that are not fulfilling the responsibility or are alleged to be committing fraud, so that that's flagged across the statewide enterprise so other people don't give grants or contracts to them. So that's one of the pieces of this bill. The other significant piece of this bill is that we are providing a very detailed definition of what grants management responsibilities are. Again, this varies widely across agencies, and it's not currently embedded in people's job description. And in a bill, an earlier version of this bill that I had for 6 years that I worked on for many years with the Office of Legislative Auditor, that was one of the big concerns, is that if people's job description or responsibilities isn't spelled out for grants management, then it becomes a game of hot potato. Well, that wasn't my job. That wasn't my job. That was someone else signed off on this. And so that's why it's been hard to have accountability. So that's the first piece in there. And then the other piece we heard from the from both agencies and the Office of Grants Management is that the Office of Grants Management provides 13 training modules, but they are recommended to agency employees who have grants management responsibilities, but they are not required. And I know I was stunned to realize that, and I think others of the committee were as well. So we are now going to be requiring grants management, people with grants management responsibilities to actually go through the training and also to be certified that they successfully completed it. Because it's one thing to sit there and watch a webinar and check the box saying you took the training, but it's another thing to demonstrate capability and success at uptake of the knowledge. And then the other piece of it is this issue of being debarred or suspended and having the uniform reporting place where everyone can understand that there's a problem with this grantee or this business and it should be a flag. So those are the pieces of the bill. I know I've heard from one of the agencies that had concern the way it's currently drafted. each agency can debar, and the preference by DHS was that we say, no, everyone reports in to OGM, and OGM makes the final determination of who is debarred. So an agency like DHS could flag an instance of fraud or alleged fraud and say, I recommend that this grantee be debarred, but the actual decision to debar or suspend would be from OGM. And honestly, one of the concerns is that people will have different thresholds, but the second concern was for the fiscal note. If we left it up to each agency, they were going to be requesting a lot more staff, whereas if we keep it housed in the central location of OGM, they felt there would be more consistency and it would be less costly. So there is an amendment that I've submitted for the committee's consideration on that point. And I just wanted to flag for you what that means. So with that, I believe I have a testifier, the Office of Legislative Auditor, and also, please come forward, and someone from the Department of Admin from the Office of Grants Management.
Thank you. Thank you. Can you please state your name for the record?
Thank you. Thank you, and good morning, Vice Chair Anderson and members of the committee. My name is Betsy Hayes. I'm an assistant commissioner with the Department of Administration, or admin. I appreciate the opportunity to testify on House File 2891 today. A significant portion of the bill is focused on creating a new certification program that would serve to verify proficiency in many areas of grants administration. Admin supports this idea, and in fact, although on a smaller scale, admin administers similar non-statutory certification programs in the procurement area. In 2023, the legislature provided additional resources to Admin's Office of Grants Management, which has allowed us to expand our training offerings considerably. Since that time, we've been rolling out courses and platforms to get state staff trained. Since July 1 of 2024, over 300 state staff have attended one or more of the 15 virtual and in-person 2.5-hour training sessions that the office has delivered. These enterprise-wide trainings build essential skills and areas of knowledge critical to grants oversight and accountability. Examples of available classes include an overview of grants administration, financial reconciliation and grants management, grant monitoring, and grantee evaluation. Online training videos, templates, checklists, sample communication, tip sheets, flowcharts, and FAQs are all available in a comprehensive toolkit related to conducting pre-award risk assessments. Further, OGM is currently working with MMB to launch a three-course training series that will be available on the state's enterprise learning system by the end of the fiscal year. There are also dozens of trainings and templates and checklists and other materials on the division's website. So adding a certification element to this would bolster this already strengthened training regimen. So again, we really support the idea, but would like to point out some ways we think that the bill could be improved. First and most critical, the development of additional training content, testing, and building the certification program will require additional resources to supplement OGM's small team. Those details are reflected in our fiscal note that we have prepared. And second, and also critical, the bill needs to identify an effective date that reflects a reasonable amount of time to design and develop and implement a certification program of this size and importance, which we estimate to be about 18 months. This would allow time to onboard the additional staff to design and develop the certification program, and then allow the remaining time for agencies to complete their certifications. Moving on to Section 2 of the bill, this section includes a list of items that admin would be required to maintain. One of the items to be maintained is a list of grantees that have been convicted of a crime involving the misuse of government funds. While we understand the usefulness of such a list, being able to identify and ascertain this list is not feasible, especially without any limits on jurisdiction. As written, admin would be required to research and locate every criminal conviction and also review the content of the crime to ensure the conviction related to misuse of government funds. Finally, and moving on to Section 4 of the bill and provisions related to grants administration, and as we previously testified in the State Government Committee, we understand the intent behind unannounced visits. We think the bill would be improved if it utilized the term site visits as opposed to a monitoring visit. A monitoring visit is an extensive review that requires planning and coordination with the grantee. Monitoring visits require certain personnel to be available, documents ready, and attendees prepared for discussion. We believe what you're intending in this bill is more of a site visit where an agency would stop in unannounced for a short check-in for the purpose of verifying that the operations are proceeding as they should be. We think these types of site visits may not always be necessary or reasonable for all types of grants, but we agree that it is appropriate and useful for some. We've heard concerns from agencies regarding the unannounced site visits about their capacity to meet this requirement, as well as other concerns. This provision would require further discussion with other grant-making agencies to ensure their needs and concerns are addressed. Agencies will need adequate funding to accommodate additional grants management requirements. And the exceptions that were detailed in Representative Davis's House File 2 should also be considered, such as for grantees that do not operate from a fixed physical address. This concludes my remarks. I thank you for the opportunity to testify, and thank you for the work and goals behind this bill. And I'm happy to stand for any questions.
Thank you. Are there any questions of the testifier? Any specific question? Okay. Thank you. Then we'll bring it back to the committee. Questions for the author?
Well, we have another testifier, but if you wouldn't mind, Madam Chair, I would just like to comment. I appreciate the partnership we've had with admin, and I do especially am interested if we do move forward with this language next session, that I would concur about the need for changing it from a monitoring visit to a site visit. And we are still trying to get a fiscal note on this bill, but I saw an early copy this morning that's not for distribution. And currently it's about $7 million per biennium. So $7 million for 26, 27, and then $7 million in the tails. So we would have to invest in this, members, but $7 million to stop hundreds of millions in fraud, I think would be well worth the investment, and I hope we can continue to work on this as a committee.
Thank you. Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I did have a question for the testifier. You had mentioned that it was, in your view, unfeasible to maintain that list of folks who have had criminal charges. Is that analysis based upon applying this retroactively, or would there be a possibility of setting something up that going forward from a certain date, you would be able to at least align or create a list based upon things that are discovered moving forward?
Thank you. Assistant Commissioner Hayes.
Madam Vice Chair, Representative, it wasn't so much about the timing or whether it's retroactive or not. It's more just the depth and the scope of the requirement. It doesn't limit jurisdiction, so if there were a conviction in a different state, it would require our staff, which now is currently 8 individuals, to really be proactively researching every jurisdiction at every level. And then further, it specifies what type of crime, and so it may even require research into the content of the case to understand what the conviction was for and whether it involved misuse of government funds. So it's really just, I think, needing to work on the language to limit the scope of what would be feasible or practicable for an office to reasonably maintain.
Representative Hudson, follow up? Okay, any other questions? Okay, we do have a second testifier.
Yes, the office, Judy Randall is here. Okay. Thank you. Thank you for coming.
Thank you. Oh, hi. Okay. Yeah, you're on my list. Thank you. Please state your name for the record.
excuse me. Thank you, Madam Chair, members. For the record, my name is Judy Randall, Legislative Auditor. Thanks for taking the time to. Sorry, I'm just going to put that down. To hear my brief comments. Most of the comments I have are related to a program evaluation OLA released in 2023 that I believe we spoke about earlier this session regarding oversight of state-funded grants to nonprofit organizations. And I'm just going to pull up the bill on my phone because the copies were gone by the time I got here. I wanted to just say the Section 3 regarding requiring training for agency employees who are responsible for grants management is consistent with our recommendation. We made several recommendations in that report. One was to for the legislature to require admin to develop robust training for employees in agencies who are managing grants. And as you already heard, the agency has already done that really without the direction from the legislature. And I was on their website last week, and they have a whole range of topics and templates and webinars and really a whole host of training materials, which is great. When we did our work, we did surveys of agency staff who manage grants. We did surveys of a grant management committee. We had some focus groups. And what we heard was a lot of large percentage, almost 75% of the employees we surveyed were not aware of all the training that was available to them, did not know whether they had taken training. And these are the folks on the front line who we're expecting to uphold the policies that are already in place. I think one thing that's really important for the legislature to hear is that a lot of the rules and requirements that you are looking for are already in place. Office of Grants Management has a robust set of policies. The legislature put into place a whole bunch of requirements in 23. The real issue, one of the real issues we see, is that state employees don't necessarily know all of them, haven't necessarily been trained on all of them. There is a lot of turnover in agency staff. A lot of staff conduct grants management functions. And so requiring training for those folks in some form, we think, is really important to make sure the folks who we are expecting to do the work actually know what's expected of them. Regarding other sections of the bill, I will just note that in this 2023 report, we did kind of a compendium of our work related to grants over the past 5+ years. We have done a lot of work related to grants oversight. We have 8 financial audit reports and 2 program evaluation reports with the findings in the back of this 23 report. And a consistent theme we see is problems related to monitoring. Right now, OGM policies do not require on-site visits, and we do think that's an important piece of accountability. I think the change the Department of Administration is recommending, changing it to site visits rather than monitoring visits, is a good one. I do think that that captures the intent, which is just to look and say, is this happening, right? Is there a program here? Are there the necessary pieces we would expect, rather than doing everything that's involved in a technical monitoring visit, which would include financial reconciliation and other things. Finally, there's a piece in here related to reporting. And I would just say that there are already requirements on the books related to reporting possible misuse of state resources, reporting to OLA. That being said, we are doing a lot of work this year reminding agencies and helping agencies understand that responsibility. We do have some language going through both bodies that we're hoping will clarify that. I don't think there's a problem with over-reporting because right now we don't believe we're getting all the reports we should be. I will note that when we do receive a credible allegation of misuse with a grantee, we do have access to look at SWIFT, which is like the state's checkbook, if you will. We have the ability to look at that across all agencies, which other agencies do not have that ability. And we do run queries. And if we see that that grantee has received a contract or funds from another agency, we will get in touch with them and maybe ask to see if they're doing monitoring and things like that. But we don't have the authority to share with them, hey, we're concerned, there's an allegation. So we use our authority carefully to make sure the agency is doing the oversight it should be when we learn of those allegations, but our authority is limited to that. I think that's everything I have. I'll be happy to answer questions. Thanks.
Thank you, Auditor Randall. Questions for Auditor? Any questions?
Thank you.
Okay, Chair Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I appreciate the opportunity to present these bills. I think it is reflective of the good work our committee has done this session. And I want to point out how salient it is in real time. So today we had the Office of the Attorney General's Medicaid Fraud Control Unit here. And to the point about the site visits, that's why this is so incredibly important. So I'm quoting from a June 19th, 2024 announcement by the fraud unit that they had announced charges for stealing more than $10 million in 2 different Medicaid prosecutions. And this was an example of a home-based community service, and they lacked, it says, one of the tip-offs for them was it lacked any office building, and they had operated for years out of a mailbox. If there had been a site visit, that would have been discovered years ago, and we wouldn't have gotten to $10 million in fraud. Here's one from January 8th of this year, 2025. They charged one person with $7.3 million in Medicaid fraud. And the situation here is that the owner of the business, as we heard in the earlier testimony, was legally barred from owning it because he had previously been convicted of aiding and abetting second-degree murder, and so was barred from owning, managing, or operating any Medicaid fraud business. But in addition, the person who he had running his billing operation was also barred because of previous identity theft. And she, at one point in this this scandal, was billing from jail. Members, if we were doing any sort of site visit, these things would have been caught much earlier. Here we are going years later to get to the final stage of prosecution by the Attorney General's office, and they're doing good work. But we need to tighten up the front end of agency oversight by having site visits so we catch this earlier. This is exactly the kind of work this bill is intended to do, and I hope we can get it over the finish line next session. But any of the pieces that are moving this session, I hope we all commit to working with our colleagues to getting them through. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Robbins, and picking up on where you ended, which is my understanding and having heard both in this committee as well as hearing, including the Medicaid Fraud Control Unit's proposal, that most of that is focused on this issue and some of the issues we've heard about Medicaid fraud and the systems we use. When I look at 289.1, I just want to be clear, because there's been a lot of confusion in this committee. There is a different process. There are a different set of rules, and to a certain degree, there's a different set of statutes that deal with nonprofit grants than deal with Medicaid provider reimbursements. And this bill is about nonprofit grants. And I know we spent 2.5 months before we got to the Medicaid Fraud Control Unit talking about grants. That's actually not where we are seeing, when even if you look at the disputed and I would say inaccurate fraud tracker, but certainly when you look at what both the government is tracking, the main issue we are talking about, and I think I heard from this committee, is Medicaid provider fraud. Those are private providers. This bill, 289.1, doesn't, I think I'm reading it right, it covers government grants. And so when we look at the list that we heard, I think Director Wonka talk about, it'd be helpful to have information sharing. A lot of that information sharing is in Representative Pinto's bill. I think that there's some in the AG's bill. But this wouldn't actually do that, because this just says a list of grantees. And when we talk about providers, they're not grantees. They're private providers. And so, one, I think it really matters, because I want to make sure that we have the tools that we're saying we want, which I agree with, which is I want the tools to say, one, I think thinking about licensing, mm-hmm. two, thinking about the tools we need to ensure that Medicaid providers are, we are actually looking at the business model and we are preventing them from doing what we see in misclassification and other places, which is dissolve when they get caught and then re-pop up. Nothing in 289.1 would do that, because we're talking about nonprofit grants, which is a different model. So we do need to be really clear that when we're talking about attacking the business model of fraud, we are actually looking at the right business model. And I don't think it is useful to our work to conflate those two, which I think we have. What I will say is I do think that looking at the bills that are moving forward through the process, looking at the bills that I think, given where they're at in the House and Senate, will become law, they do get to this point that we heard Director Wonka, and I think there's more work to do, I am really interested in looking at, when we talk about home health care, about licensing. I am really interested in looking at where we are doing it well with PCAs and applying it to the rest of the model. But I think that the, to a certain degree, the focus on grants, particularly grants to nonprofits, although there are grants that go to for-profit providers too, that has actually taken us away from the work of looking at Medicaid provider fraud, which we're now getting to late in the game, and I'm glad we are. But so I would say, especially 289.1, I just wanted to make sure we're not expecting it to do things that it can't do because it's focused on the wrong set of actors and the wrong problem. So that's what I would say.
Thank you. And Representative, I think it's important, we know there's, I agree with Representative Greenman in generally that there are nonprofit grants generally go to nonprofits, but sometimes they go to profits. The difference there is that we don't actually have things to judge them by, whether what they did was fraudulent or not, or whether they did anything for the dollars that they got from the grants. In regards to Medicaid, the dollars are supposed to be fee for service, and the question is, were those services even provided? And so they are two very different things, the grants, I think, and Medicaid, which is not generally grants, but both have public and private entities involved. So thank you, Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Representative or Chair Anderson. I will say that we actually do, and a lot of the language that the auditor mentioned that we added in 2023 and 2024 actually does give us the tools to say both on the front end, do you have and are you going to do what you say you do, but also to withhold payment if they're not doing what the grants say. So there is this conversation that I think all of us share about what it means to direct directly appropriate grants, what the legislature is setting those up. But when you look at competitive grants, there are a set of metrics, and we do actually now have the tools to hold them accountable. So I just wanted to dispute a little bit the idea that when we make nonprofit grants, we somehow, they go into the ether. We now have much better tools in some cases for nonprofit grants than we do for contracts that we're vending out, that our agencies are vending out to just businesses. We have better tools with nonprofit grants than we do for tax expenditures that are in some cases going hundreds of millions of dollars that are going out the door. Look at the research and development tax credit that the auditor has actually said. We don't know what we're getting for it. We have better tools than we do, I think, in some cases for this Medicaid provider fraud. So we have actually spent a lot of time, I think, looking at the nonprofit grant space and put a lot of stuff into play. I think the rest of this piece, whether it's tax expenditures, whether it's Medicaid fraud, we are now getting to this place of how do we make sure that we're holding it to accountable to the goals that we set.
Thank you. May I respond,
Madam Chair?
Yeah, interesting note, the R&D tax credit's not in the tax bill. That's coming out tomorrow. So interesting note. Chair Robbins.
Yes, thank you, Representative Greenman, for those points. And I agree. I think we have to continue to look at all the buckets of fraud. Mm-hmm. Medicaid is a huge piece of it, but there are areas of grants where there's nonprofit fraud that we have seen, and the grants management has not been sufficient, as we have seen throughout the testimony. And then there's the unlicensed, generally business fraud that we've identified often in the Medicaid expansion area, where we need to tighten that down. But in all those cases, site visits are important. And I agree, this bill is dealing with the grants piece, but we need to be sure that there are billions of dollars, state dollars, going out in grants. And we need to make sure, as part of our charge as the State Agency Oversight Committee, that the people managing these grants on behalf of taxpayers take the training that's offered and that they understand their job and are doing it well. And many of them are. But as the OLA said, many people who manage grants, there's a lot of turnover. They aren't even aware the training's available. So that's on us to make sure that as the state legislature appropriating funds where it's granted out, that we're ensuring that the agency staff are well-trained managing that grant money well. So it is very important. And then there's overlap. Members, we saw this in Feeding Our Future, and we are continuing to see it in real time with warrants that were executed in December of last year, where there is an autism center, which is a business that was also tied to a nonprofit that is a Feeding Our Future site that also has non-emergency transportation that also has interpretive services. So there is overlap between the nonprofits and the businesses that are involved in the business model of fraud we are all trying to define and limit. So I just think that we have to acknowledge that all these buckets of potential fraud exist and that we have a responsibility to be working in all these lanes. Medicaid, the unlicensed or business area, including some of the managed care organizations, not just the individual businesses, and the grants. So I think we can do all, and I think we shouldn't limit our focus. We should instead be working in all three buckets, and I appreciate the work of this committee this session.
Thank you. Representative Rarick, quickly.
Just really quickly, so just to the point of the tracker that we keep refuting. Mm-hmm. So it's $610 million, and it's across all kinds of things. If we just did the simple math, again, $20 billion annually coming in for Medicaid, if we had an exceptionally low fraud rate, 1%, that's $200 million, Representative Greenman, $200 million, that's just Medicaid. If it was an exceptionally low fraud rate. So I don't know why we keep pushing back on this tracker. It's probably incredibly low at $610 million. And that, again, that's 1 year's worth of fraud. So $20 billion, 1% fraud rate, which is incredibly low, nets you $200 million, just simple math, a year of Medicaid fraud. And maybe it's half of that. Okay, so $100 million a year. It's still an incredible amount of money going out. And as we've been working through these bills, this committee, talking to whistleblowers, as the chair just said, we have heard a complexity and an industry of fraud in Minnesota that is like nowhere else in the nation. That's actually what two now U.S. attorney generals have said. So I think we have a huge problem. I don't know why we keep pushing back on the fraud tracker, because it's incredibly low, but just do the simple math. Thank you.
Thank you. We have 2 minutes. Anyone else? Okay. Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to point out that, as kind of a closing comment on the experience of this session, it's been interesting being in this committee while also being in education finance, and the contrast that I've observed between the commitment to scrutinize literally everything that our school districts do and to micromanage it down to the dollar versus the seeming just everything's okay when it comes to these nonprofit grants. We just give them money and trust that they're doing what they're doing. It would be fascinating to live in a world where we flipped that script, where we had the type of micromanagement and scrutiny applied to our school districts, applied to these nonprofits that are receiving grants and are obviously getting away with hundreds of millions of dollars worth of fraud, and we actually trusted our government entities that have elected officials in place at the school board level. There seems to be this odd disparity in our treatment of our local communities that are government entities and these nonprofits that we just hand money to and trust that they're going to do what they say.
Thank you, Representative Hudson, and I hope that we work on some of that, those issues, over the interim. Oh, Representative Pinnell.
I'll be very quick, Madam Chair. And I guess just to confirm, nobody's saying that things are hunky-dory at all. We just want to make sure that we have, that if we're going to be driving towards solutions, that we make sure that we truly, truly understand the problem. When I look at HF 2891, it relates a lot to nonprofit grant management, but in fact, as we just were hearing today, so much is about Medicaid fraud. In fact, even when I look at the oft-refuted tracker referenced by Representative Rarick, so many of the items on the list, in fact, would not, HF 2891 would not apply to. So I appreciate that over the course of these hearings, we've heard a lot about grants management policies. We've had a lot of discussion about state agencies' actions in various ways. I appreciate it today especially. We got into, in a really credible way some of the details of how fraud programs, of how fraud is occurring. Not at all pushing back on the idea that's occurring. We want to make sure that we understand it well in order to drive towards solutions. So I appreciate Chair Robbins' reference that HF 2091 is one that she sees as the bill path being something that would come up next session. But there are other things, I think, especially from the governor's package, that are moving in bills this session and building, I should say, on the work that we've all done over the last number of sessions. So let's continue to take to work based on credible, specific information. It's easy to make broad, conclusory statements. We want to make sure that we're looking at concrete information and taking action based on that. And we can be proud of a lot of the things that are moving in bills this session that are doing just that. And this is something we'll look forward to discussing next session, as the chair had said. So thank you, Chair Robbins, and thank you, Chair Anderson.
Thank you, Chair Robbins.
Thank you. In closing, I appreciate that, Representative Pinto, but I want to remind the committee that these suggestions in 2891 came from the agencies and from the OLA. There have been OLA report after OLA report about fraud in grants management. And we have made steps towards addressing some of that, but these are recommendations they requested that we tighten up, that we require the training, that we ensure that state agencies whose staff have grant oversight actually know how to perform the functions. That we have a list of required functions, like closing out the grant before final payment is made. Members, these are simple things that, honestly, I think we took for granted were happening, but they have not been happening. And I'm not a fan of micromanaging in statute down to this level, but that is what they are asking for, because it is not happening across all the agencies. And if we are going to clean up this mess of fraud, whether it's Medicaid, whether it's with providers, or whether it's in nonprofit grants management, we should be responsive to the things they have asked for. And these recommendations came out of our hearings. So I look forward to continuing this work with all of you. And I do will advise you on schedules over the summer, but we do hope to meet in the interim to continue this work. Thank you, members.
Thank you. We're adjourned.